For my microphones in downtown Washington, D.C., this is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Back at our microphones for a third time, Bill Burrell. He is an independent corrections management consultant. Bill served as 19 years as chief of adult probation services for the New Jersey State Court System. And that's the really impressive thing to me, that he has one foot in the practitioner community and yet one foot in the academic community. From 2003 to 2007, he was a member of the faculty in the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University in Philadelphia. Bill is chairman of the editorial committee for Perspectives, the Journal of the American Probation and Parole Association, and he serves as a member of APPA's board of directors. And Bill currently serves as a member of the editorial board for Community Corrections Report. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now up to 177,000 requests during the month of July for D.C. Public Safety. Once again, we're profoundly just impressed by all the calls and letters and emails and the other communications that you're providing to us in terms of what you'd like to see in the show, what you agree with, what you disagree with. Feel free to get back in touch with us. My email is Leonard, L-E-O-N-A-R-D dot Sipes, S-I-P, not T, but P-E-S at C-S-O-S-A dot gov, or get in touch with us through the comments box on the four websites for D.C. Public Safety, or follow me on Twitter at Twitter/LenSipes. Bill Burrell, once again, we appreciate you being on the program. You're the only person who's ever done D.C. Public Safety three times.
Well, I'm honored to have that distinction. Good to be back with you, Lynn.
All right. We've been having a lot of fun, and I've been getting a lot of comments as to how interesting this series of shows, these shows are as to what works in parole and probation. Because the first show, what we did was we summarized this sense of frustration in the practitioner community as to the lack of specific guidelines as to what it is they could be doing, should be doing. We talked about the National Institute for Drug Abuse and the fact that they have very specific guidelines. They have everything down to a science as to assessment as to what to do with that particular kind of individual, how long the treatment should be, the kind of treatment that the individual should undergo, what sort of aftercare that person should have. I mean, it's down to a science. And what we basically agreed to was the National Institute of Drug Abuse has been around for decades, and the research on community-based corrections and specifically reentry from prison is just beginning, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. The second program, we talked about a couple programs out there, one from the state of Maryland and one from the state of Oklahoma, as to what it is that they're doing regarding reentry and the fact that they have good documentation backing them up, and the fact that the Maryland program is available on our website for D.C. Public Safety, and the link is directly there for that. This show, what we wanted to do was to go over related modalities. Now, what in the heck does that mean? Well, we just talked about drug treatment, the fact that, you know, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, they have very specific guidelines as to what to do regarding drug treatment, but there are other modalities, such as cognitive therapy, that has been around for decades that should be able to guide us and does guide us in terms of the things that parole and probation agencies could be doing regarding parole and probation practices and offender reentry. And Bill says he wants to discuss this from the standpoint of who, in other words, what kind of offender, what should we do, and finally, how should we do it? So, Bill, take it from there.
Well, thank you, Len. Yeah, I want to summarize it and talk a little bit about the research that now falls under the label of evidence-based practices, and prior to that was called What Works. And this is a rich body of research that goes back probably to the 70s. So there's a lot of research. Part of the challenge is getting that research into the hands of the practitioners. So we want to talk about these three areas that you mentioned, principles that have emerged from the research, and the lead researchers in this area are people such as Don Andrews and Paul Gendreau and Jim Botta, some Canadians who've done some amazing research to refute the idea that there's nothing you can do with criminal offenders to help them change their behavior. Well, so we really have these three questions, as you identified. The first one is, out of these thousands of offenders that we have, and I think it's important to understand that in most agencies, and yours may be the exception, Len, most agencies, the caseloads are too large to enable probation and parole officers to do effective supervision. So we need to do some prioritization among the offenders. Look at who's in this caseload and make some decisions about who to work with and then what to do. So the first question is who to work with, and here we're guided by the risk principle. And this is a fundamental finding from the research that really is the core, the first thing we really need to start to look at. What is the risk level or the probability of a particular offender reoffending while they're under supervision? And the technology for this is much like what the insurance companies use to determine insurance rates. So it's a sound technology. It's not smoke and mirrors. It's been around for quite some time. So the first thing we want to look at is the risk level and screen out the low-risk offenders. And again, depending on the size of the organization and the composition of the caseload, it can be up to a third to a half of the offender population falls into this low-risk group.
Mm-hmm.
And these have a very low rate of reoffending, and trying to work with them will waste a lot of agency and staff time because many of them will be successful on their own. Right. So it's kind of like the needle in the haystack problem. There are some low-risk offenders who will reoffend, but trying to find them will waste a lot of time and resources.
There was a book I read years ago called Radical Non-Intervention. The premise of the book was regarding low-risk offenders, don't do anything at all with them.
Mm-hmm.
The more contact you have with them, the more you're going to end up violating them. And that's a document that goes back probably 30 years.
Right. And that second point that you mentioned, the fact that we can actually make things worse by supervising and intervening with these offenders is a critical point as well. So not only is it wasteful of resources, it also can make things worse. So let's screen those folks out, put them in some sort of program or caseload that's very low in terms of resources, whether it's an automated kiosk for reporting or some telephone reporting system, something like that, that gets them out of the regular caseloads and devotes little resources as we can to them. That leaves us with the moderate to high-risk offenders, and these are the people we really need to focus on, because these are the ones who are committing the crimes, the longer records, the more intensive problems, and really do need our intervention and assistance. And this is where we can really begin to show some results from the work that we're doing.
People who are an obvious risk to public safety.
Exactly. All right. So, in my experience in New Jersey, we had a population in the high-risk category that had a 44% failure rate. So 44% of them committed a new crime while they're under supervision.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the opposite of the needle in the haystack situation, like shooting fish in a barrel. Every other offender, in essence, was going to commit a new crime. So if we were able to target these individuals and be successful, we can have a significant impact on the amount of crime committed by these offenders under supervision.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those numbers hold pretty much across jurisdictions. You have a group of people that are pretty active in terms of committing crimes, and you can target them and provide them with the right kinds of services, you'll have a significant impact on public safety.
Because even if you can reduce it by 10 or 15%, that's fairly significant in terms of the cost to the state alone, in terms of the recidivism, the amount of people coming back into the prison system. I mean, beyond sheer public safety and beyond sheer citizen protection, states are also struggling throughout this country. Most of the states are struggling with budget. So the fact that fewer people are going to be coming back into the prison system is a huge plus in terms of managing state budgets.
Right. And I think that's one of the factors that's really driving a lot of the work in the field at the moment is how can we save some money? How can we get people out of prison and put them in the community yet keep the community safe? And I think that's where this concept of risk assessment, identifying those high, moderate and high-risk offenders, that's where you want to apply your resources. That's the kind of strategy that's going to produce the results that we're looking for.
Okay. The next category is what?
Well, yes, now that we've figured out who we're going to work with, what do we focus on? What parts of their lives, their situations do we focus on? Because there's lots of things that people assume are related to the reoffending. First thing most people think about is drugs, right? Mm-hmm. And the research suggests that there are a number of what are known in the literature as criminogenic needs or criminogenic factors. These are things that drive people to commit crimes, right? And included in there are substance abuse, but there are others that are higher on the list in terms of their impact. Mm-hmm. And the first is something we call antisocial attitudes, values, and beliefs. And this is just basically saying that offenders think it's okay to commit crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So once you've taken away this social condemnation of crime as a bad thing, then it becomes a normal and accepted and easy thing for them to do. So we have to begin to target in on these attitudes and values and beliefs that they have. They also hang out with other people, pro-criminal associates, so they're hanging out with people who share that value set, so it's kind of reinforcing. They have a history of antisocial behavior. They've committed crimes before. So you have a group of people with this way of looking at the world that says it's okay to commit crimes. So one of the things that we have to begin to do is to work on that attitude and value set and find new activities for them to engage in. That's why employment is so important in our field, giving hopefully 6 or 7, 8 hours a day where they're engaged in some sort of constructive pro-social activity.
Right.
Okay. Then you have some of the other criminogenic factors include poor use of leisure time, family home problems, schoolwork problems, those kinds of things all contribute to this.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be looking at the offenders and using these assessment instruments, because in addition to looking at risk, we have good, reliable, valid, user-friendly needs assessments that will identify the types of criminogenic needs and problems that individuals have and can also begin to suggest ways to effectively deal with that offender and these particular set of problems they have.
Now, the bottom line is just that the assessment process, we really can, the research I think is abundantly clear, we really can assess an individual, and we can assess that individual for the level of drug use, the level of antisocial personalities, the level of mental illness, because we have a BJS report that suggests that in excess of 50% of offenders self-diagnose themselves as having mental health problems. We can diagnose all that. We can pretty much assess that with a fairly reasonable degree of accuracy, and from that, figure out who that person is and what their future propensity is for committing other offenses, and create both a treatment and a supervision schedule strategy to meet that individual offender's needs.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. And we really can do that. I want to emphasize that the state of the research is such that the state of assessment, again, we draw from decades of research in terms of assessing a human person. And that yet is another example as to the fact that, again, we have decades of related research that we can draw from to help us come to grips with what we're going to do with that particular offender.
That's correct.
Okay. And how?
And well, one point I want to add to that your last comment about decades of research, and the fact is that none of these assessment instruments are beyond the capability of any probation and parole officer to use with the proper training and mm-hmm. supervision. This is not, you don't need a PhD, a MD, or any sort of D after your name to be able to use these instruments effectively and to integrate them into the ongoing work of the community supervision officers. Now, that's good news.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, we do not need to hire a whole slew of clinical psychologists to do this kind of work.
But just a couple of years ago, that's exactly what we did. And now it's advanced to the point where the average parole and probation agent can effectively do it himself or herself.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Cool.
That's correct. So now we identify who we're going to work with, and with those individuals, what we're going to focus on. Then the last part of the puzzle here is how to go about dealing. So once we identify the problems, well, that's great. But what do we do with them? And this is where the field of psychology has been so helpful to us with this concept or this notion of cognitive behavioral interventions or cognitive behavioral therapy. I prefer interventions because our folks are not trained clinicians, so they're really not doing therapy. But that doesn't mean there aren't a lot of things that the individual probation parole officer can do every day in routine contacts with their caseload that can implement cognitive behavioral interventions. So what we're looking at, you remember we go back to the idea of the offenders having a set of attitudes, values, and beliefs, mm-hmm. and thinking patterns that lead them to criminal behavior. Some in the field call them criminal thinking errors.
Mm-hmm.
So the challenge is for the officer to, in their discussions with offenders, identify these criminal thinking errors, or A, be aware of what they look like and sound like, and identify them, confront the offender about them, talk about their ways of thinking about the world and thinking about individuals and themselves, show them how these attitudes, values, and beliefs and errors lead to them committing crime, start to generate some possible alternative ways of thinking and acting, and give them some training, some coaching on new skills and behaviors, give them an opportunity to practice those through role plays and role modeling, and reward them when they begin to talk the right way, to think the right way, to act the right way. Because the way human beings change their behavior is they get rewarded. And unfortunately, a lot of the folks we have supervised have been rewarded for all the bad things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get status in their community for committing crime, selling drugs, and
Violence is good. How many offenders have sat with me and simply said, Mr. Sipes, violence is good?
Mm-hmm.
Violence is what protects you. It protects your property. It protects your girlfriend. It protects your mother. It protects the mother of your children. It protects your children. I mean, violence is a day-to-day commodity, and I understand that you don't get that, but in our world, that's something that does exist. Well, that's not something that you can take through life and do successfully and expect to be any place else but behind bars.
Right. And one of the effective techniques that we have found is to start to talk with offenders about their goals and aspirations and desires for their lives. And, you know, interestingly enough, they have some of the same goals and aspirations as normal pro-social citizens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they want to reconcile with their kids. They want to buy a house. They want to own their own business, whatever it is. But obviously, as you mentioned, you know, someone living a life of violence on the streets is not building the framework or the foundation for being able to open their own business or buy a house or whatever.
But the average person listening to this who is not part of the parole and probation system is simply going to say that's ridiculous. Those are values that you're brought up with in a household. Those are the larger values of society. Those are the larger values of religion. You mean to tell me that there are individuals, and I've had this question lots of times, that there are individuals out there who really do not know that theft is bad, that violence is bad, and that both are going to be a guaranteed ticket to something along the lines of prison or worse.
Mm-hmm.
The average person listening to this program right now is not going to understand why you need to help that person retrain his thinking process as to the fact that just because you have a perceived insult, that does not mean that you strike out at another person. They have a hard time understanding why that's necessary.
Well, you've really identified the difficulty of the challenge is that a probation parole officer working with an individual offender, even if they're seeing them on an intensive supervision scheme of, you know, several times a week, that's still only a fraction of that person's waking hours.
Mm-hmm.
And they go back to the neighborhood, the community, the house, the apartment where they are living, and back into that milieu of violence and crime and drugs and so on. So that, you know, part of the challenge is how to figure out ways to give them more time away from that is in a positive pro-social type of activity. Work, obviously, is a big one. School for younger offenders. I'm a big fan of community service as a part of a sentencing scheme because not only does it pay back to some extent, the damage done to the community at large, it also engages the offender with a group of pro-social people in working in some sort of positive contribution, some activity in the community that's valued. So they get some, exposure to other people that are living the kind of life we want them to be able to be living, and keeps them away from the bad influences. I mean, it's a challenge to try to talk to an offender and say, all right, all the people you're hanging out with, shouldn't be hanging out with them anymore because they're bad for you. So this is a long process that a probation parole officer has to engage in to begin to tap into the offender's internal motivations, show how their thinking and behavior patterns are leading them to continued involvement with the court and with the justice system, and preventing them from achieving the things that they individually have identified that they would like to be able to have.
And the bottom line in all of this is that cognitive behavioral therapy, or thinking for a change, as it's called in some places, or just rearranging the thinking patterns of a criminal offender, is possible, is doable, happens every day. And it happens in terms of the relationship between the parole and probation agent and the offender that he or she is supervising. It happens every single day. And there's decades of research that backs up the concept.
Yes, and you used a critical term in your summary there, Len, relationship. We need to focus on the relationship between the offender and the officer. The old kind of supervision where people came into the office, it was a five-minute perfunctory contact. You live in the same place? Yeah. You still working? Yeah. Been arrested? No. Okay, down the hall, you know, make a payment on your supervision fees and give me a drug test and mm-hmm. see you in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. That's not supervision. So we're talking about changing the way the officers conceive of their role, one as helping offenders to change, and engaging them in a relationship, a trusting interpersonal relationship. And sometimes this is a hard concept for officers to swallow. But when you think about your own life experiences, the people that were influential in your life that encouraged you to learn and grow and change were people that you trusted. An officer sitting there telling an offender, just lecturing them, wagging their finger at them, telling them, do this, do that, so on. We know that the offenders are not listening because they don't believe that this person has their interests at heart. When an officer can begin to build a solid, trusting relationship that tells the offender through deeds and actions, not so much just the words, that the officer is interested in helping this person achieve some of these things that they've identified and helping them change their behavior, then there's some hope that the offender will listen and will actually act on the suggestions and the recommendations of the officer. But until we get to the point where we build these working relationships, working alliances, therapeutic alliances, they go under a lot of different terms in different literatures, but the fundamental thing is we need to begin to build that solid relationship so that we have a chance of influencing the offender's behavior.
And I've spoken to, more than just a couple parole and probation agents in my career. And my response to their negative reaction to this concept was, it doesn't stop you from doing the enforcement actions. If you can do whatever enforcement actions you feel a need to do to protect public safety, that doesn't stop any of that. But at the same time, if you're going to talk to them, trying to gain their trust and try to depend upon research that's been around for decades to help you reach him, you want him to go to drug treatment. We all want him to go to drug treatment. He, in fact, would probably like to go to drug treatment. His family wants him to go to drug treatment. But just reading him the Riot Act is not going to get him in drug treatment.
Exactly right. And again, that last point is critical to the role and the responsibilities of the probation and parole officer. It's not just monitoring contacts, monitoring compliance with conditions, and then enforcing it, what we called trail them, nail them, and jail them. But the job entails, in addition to monitoring, which is part of what we have to do, is helping the offenders to change. Because if we don't undertake some type of effort to get the offenders to change, then we're literally just chasing our tails.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've been doing for the last 30, 35 years, is chasing our tails, locking people up to get back out. It's a huge catch-and-release system. They waste the money, waste lives. And I think from, you know, my background in the field, I think it's a much more rewarding type of work to do. It's harder. There's no doubt about it. You have to think more. But I think that most people that I've met in the system have a basic desire to help offenders do better. Mm-hmm. What they're wondering is, how do I do that? They're not sure how to go about accomplishing that. But they're in the business because they do have some level of commitment to making the community safer, helping offenders change their behavior, so they're not just caught up in this endless cycle of incarceration and supervision.
Well, and there's really good research out there that basically says exactly what you're suggesting, and that is that it has to be a dual approach. It cannot be simply supervision. Supervision just produces more failure. That it has to be a combination of supervision and programs, and that if you dealt with the programmatic needs of the offender, in other words, if the person is mentally ill, for the love of good graciousness, please get the offender involved in a program that addresses his mental illness. Nobody's going to disagree with that. If a person has a long history of drugs and a long history of the drugs getting them involved in problems, get them involved in drug treatment. That seems to be a universal consensus of the research.
Yes. I mean, it is as simple yet complex as the statement of, if these are the factors, these criminogenic factors, if these are the factors that lead people to commit crime, what we want to do is to mitigate, reduce, eliminate those factors so there's reduced chance of people committing crimes.
Okay. We're in the final 4 minutes of the program with Bill Burrell. Bill, the bottom line in all of this is that none of this, however, is neatly packaged in one particular place. Now, I can think of three or four research examples that basically say it's got to be a combination of programs and supervision. And to those friends of mine in parole and probation agencies throughout the country who carry guns, who have law enforcement authority, and who believe that you really have to ride herd on the offender, I don't disagree with that, and I don't think Bill Burrell disagrees with that, and I don't think the criminological community disagrees with that, but putting them in programs, getting them in programs is obviously best for all of us. But that's not explained simply, quickly, neatly in a particular document to guide parole and probation people. It comes from a piece here, a piece there. It's not explained in non-technical terms, in non-research terms. It's not easily, neatly laid out for the practitioner. And do you ever see the point where we get to that document that provides a quick and easy access to the research and says, okay, in terms of lower risk offenders, here's what we mean by lower risk. Here's how you choose your lower risk offender. And here are the modalities that we suggest that you use. And here's the research that backs that up. Are we ever going to get to that point?
Oh, I sure hope so. And I think at some point someone and some enterprising author will pull all that together into one place. I think that probably the closest thing to that we have at the moment is the Tools of the Trade document that NIC published in collaboration with the Maryland Division of Parole and Probation.
And will be so cited in the show notes for this program.
Right. And I don't think that the fact that it doesn't all exist in one short, easily digestible document should deter people. I don't think it takes a lot of work to find the materials that you need. And I would encourage people at the line level, the supervisor, managerial level, to spend a little time with the research and particularly the work that the National Institute of Corrections has put out under their evidence-based practices initiative. There's lots of good stuff. It's all available for free on the web. It takes a little bit of thinking and such to integrate it. But again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, none of this stuff is beyond the capabilities of all of the staff. I don't know that I've ever met a probation officer who couldn't do this. Now, they may have a philosophical objection to it. They may feel that trail 'em, nail 'em, jail 'em is the way to go. So that's a bigger question. How do you debunk some of those beliefs and those myths to show that if we're really going to be effective, and effective meaning reducing offender failure, reducing new crimes, improving public safety, We have to go after the factors that produce the crime in a way that is likely to be effective. And we can target people, let's say who have a substance abuse problem, we can put them through a very rigorous drug testing regimen so we know exactly what they're taking and when they're taking and how much they're taking. Well, that doesn't help us because we're not dealing with the underlying addiction problem and trying to change that. So I can't envision a scheme where somebody would say to me, well, you know, we're not supposed to deal with these problems. That's not the issue. Yes, it is the issue because that's what's causing crime. And if we're in the business of improving public safety and reducing offender crime, we have to deal with those things.
And it's interesting that it's taken on a greater emphasis, Bill, now that the states have run into the budget problems that they have, and they simply cannot afford to revoke everybody that they have, and they need to have alternatives or the states are simply going to go broke. That's not from me. That's not my observation. That's the observation of budget directors in states throughout the country.
And if you look at the cost of incarceration versus the cost of community supervision, even if you took 30% of the savings that you would get by not sending somebody back to prison, so I think it's averaging $75 a day, something like that, I think is the latest Pew report, and average for probation and parole is about $5 a day. So let's say you saved one year in prison, so there's, let's say, just to do on a daily basis, $75 a day, and it only costs $5 a day to put that person on good quality supervision, increase that by $25, only give me a third of the savings from prison. Imagine how much treatment, how much intervention, how much training, how much we could reduce caseloads with that redirect and reinvestment of prison savings.
For the love of heavens, send some of the money back for programs is the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. And the states would still save money. Here in New Jersey, the parole board just won an award from the Kennedy School of Government, the Innovations in American Government, for a program that reduces the numbers of parolees sent back to prison. And we are in this state in the process of closing one of our prisons, the Riverfront State Prison in Camden, being closed. I don't say this is entirely the result of the parole board's program, but I think it has a significant impact on the prison population. So when you close a prison, now you're talking about significant savings.
Yeah, hundreds of millions of dollars every
year. Exactly. Yep.
Because the average prison, when I was with the Maryland system, I think the average budget was about $125 million a year for the average prison, let alone the construction cost. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue this conversation with a variety of other people in terms of what works with parole and probation, what works in terms of offender reentry throughout this summer. We're going to be talking to folks down at the Travis County, Texas program that Bill Burrell brought to my attention. They have a ton of documents that they have to offer to everybody. And when we do that show, we'll put those documents up on the site. I hope to get in touch with the Oklahoma people and to do a show with them and talk to, again, through Bill Burrell, and to talk to them about their innovative program. We have a judge who wrote a piece for the Pew Foundation in terms of what works from his particular point of view and what has to be, what are the key ingredients in terms of any successful parole and probation program. And we'll end this series on what works with a conversation with Associate Director Thomas Williams of my agency, the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. I know that Tom Williams was invited to go to China and delivered a major address just last year in terms of what works in community supervision. We've been discussing this concept, what works, with Bill Burrell. Bill is currently a consultant. He served for 19 years as Chief of Adult Probation Services for the state of New Jersey court system. From 2003 to 2007, he was a member of the faculty of the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University in Philadelphia. Bill is currently the chair of the editorial committee for Perspectives Magazine, the Journal of the American Probation and Parole Association, and he serves as the member of APPA's Board of Directors, and he currently serves as member of the editorial board of Community Corrections Report. Bill's email is William, W-I- BILLIAM.Burrell, BURRELL, at Comcast.net. Bill, I just want to thank you profusely for coming on in this series of programs about what works. I find your point of view fascinating and very informed. So I think you've really done a service to the community in terms of providing that overview as to what works. So I really want to thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everybody out there for supporting DC Public Safety, up to 177,000 requests for the month of July. Get in touch with me at Leonard, L-E-O-N-A-R-D, .Sipes, S-I-P-E-S, at CSOSA.gov, or comment in DC Public Safety in terms of the four websites that operate under the banner of DC Public Safety. And please, everybody, have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.